and no angels, law-defying, getting their kicks from violence and torture. The Wild Angels, starring Peter Fonda and Nancy Sinatra. In the Angel Gang, if you're one man's woman, you're his old lady.
Well, because the way I used to be and all, you know, I just figured that you thought I...
You talk too much.
If you're a mama, you're every man's woman.
All right, everybody! We race up to that end of the canyon! The first one gets Mama Monahan!
I'm ready!
Look, baby, I say we're gonna have a party now.
Listen, Frankenstein, get lost or the loser will take care of you.
Oh, man, I got more than the loser ever had.
We want to be free to ride our machines without being hassled by the man. And we want to get loaded.
Oh, no, Preach. Not children of God, but Hell's Angels.
This is Roger Corman, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
That, of course, was part of the trailer, most of the trailer, for The Wild Angels, which Roger Corman directed in 1966. This is the Film Wax Radio, and this is the Roger Corman episode. That's what we're going to call it. And it was someone who I have coveted getting on the show for, well, since I began several years back. I'm very excited to have Roger Corman on the show. For those of you who listen to the show regularly, you know what's been going on, and I told a story over a couple of episodes of my pursuit and eventual, I guess you could call it, ambush of Mr. Corman. It's very brief, I will admit that. That's why I'm sort of padding it with all sorts of other stuff like this introduction and the trailer and all this stuff. But I got to tell you a little bit about him, because if you don't know about Roger Corman, there's a lot of misconceptions. He's called the king of the B-movies, for instance, which is actually incorrect. He was making films after B-movies were already... B-movies came out, I think, around World War II, and they were trying to give people more bang for their buck. So they put in a second film in theaters, Roger Corman started making films after the advent. These were meant to be feature films, standalone films. So actually, even though he's called the king of the B-movies, that's not true. He's not the king of the B-movies. By the way, let me interrupt myself for a moment just to say, usually on my show you hear cars honking and sirens going by, because most shows, as you know, I produce out of New York City. Now what you're hearing are wind chimes, maybe crickets, maybe other flora and fauna. I'm upstate in the Finger Lakes. There's even a cool breeze. I'm sitting on a porch right now with the sun shining on the porch with a dog at my feet here. It's just beautiful. So I was thrilled to put the show together, because it was a lot of fun. And how did I put the show together? In preparation, before I even know I was going to get him for sure. In other words, I planned to pursue getting Roger on the show, but I didn't know for sure whether, until the last minute, whether or not it would work out. Working towards the ultimate goal of it working out, I did my homework. And what I did is I picked up a couple of books to fill in a lot of blanks. I had not seen a ton of Roger Corman movies, and most of which, by the way, he didn't direct. He did direct a handful of very seminal movies, but he did not direct a lot of movies. He produced a lot, and he gave many young filmmakers their start, which is well known. That group of people over a span of many years is called the Roger Corman School, because so many graduates moved on to be the top filmmakers of the day, frankly. And we'll talk about that in a second. But I picked up one book that he wrote called How I Made 100 Movies in Hollywood and Never Lost a Dime. It's almost true. He's lost very little money. And he talks about one film that lost money, which is called The Intruder, which came out in 1962. And that, of course, was starring William Shatner as a racist. That movie lost money. People apparently didn't want to go see that. It was probably at the beginning of the civil rights era, maybe even before it. And so, Corman was had his ear to the ground about something socially going on that nobody had done, started making popular culture around. And then B, people were still trying not to deal with it. Certainly didn't find it entertaining. So the movie lost money, and it starred a very young Bill Shatner. The other book that I picked up and that I read is a great coffee table photo book, but it has lots of oral history shared by many of the people and associates of Roger Corman. And it's a very entertaining book with beautiful pictures of posters and stills and grabs from the film and other promotional and marketing items. You should pick it up if you can. It was written by Chris Nashawate. I know I blew that, and he writes for Entertainment Weekly, and I put him down to contact him because I want to bring him on the show. But the name of that book is called it's called Crab Monsters, Teenage Cavemen, and Candy Stripe Nurses, Roger Corman, King of the B-Movies. So Chris, I'm sure he just grabbed the name because it's sort of what he was commonly known as, but even though I'm saying that it's not true, he's not a King of the B-Movies, you can order that from Amazon if you want. And they're both terrific books and kind of covered the same territory. But Roger wrote How I Made 100 Movies in Hollywood with the help of Jim Jerome. And that's from the DiCapo Press, that book. So pick either or both of those up. So I read the books in preparation and learned quite a bit that I feel like I should have known already. And I'm going to go over briefly a couple of real fast points because he is, you know, one of the founders of independent film. I mean, he had and still does one of the most successful independent film companies that exist. And he was the unless I'm mistaken, he was maybe the first one to do this. So he had his own whole production and distribution company. But early on, Roger Corman thought he was going to be an engineer, followed in his father's footsteps, and that very quickly became apparent that he wasn't suited for it. His family already had moved from Detroit to Beverly Hills, so he was already in Hollywood for all intents and purposes. So he ended up getting a job in the 20th Century Fox mailroom, and that was probably by what year? But that was probably, I'm guessing, the tail end of the 40s, early 50s. And by 1955, he was directing films. And he figured out very quickly, because he was astute and lucky and the timing was right, he learned how very quickly how to make a lot of movies very inexpensively and how to make a profit. And then how to continue a cycle of making films without breaking. And he did, so he would make sometimes tons of movies every year. All the way through the 50s and 60s into the 70s and 80s. And, of course, the industry changed. But the first phase of his career happened right around the advent of the television. So there was a lot of fear in the film industry that TV was going to put movies out of business. And it was the first wave of that kind of fear because it subsequently happened again with video. Now you hush. It consequently happened. And it finally happened again with the advent of course, VHS, and then again DVDs, and then VOD, and so it keeps going on. Anyway, but what Roger found out was that adults, parents, grandparents, were staying home in larger numbers, it's true, and watching TV, but that the kids, the teenagers, wanted to get out of the house. And so the drive-ins exploded, and he was making these movies for kids, or teenagers, for teenagers at the drive-ins, and they did very well, and so he made movies that would appeal to that demographic. And early on, his first wave of films were actually adaptations from Poe films, or those were some of the films that he did, because he was in love with Edgar Allan Poe's literature, and it was his dream to make it. So he actually helped rekindle the careers of several actors, like of course Vincent Price and Boris Karloff, to name a couple. And there were many others. And they were scary films. They're creepy. They're worth visiting if you haven't seen them or if you haven't seen them in a long time, because they really do hold up in a new light. So you have those films. Then, as I said, he started to make films appealing directly to teenagers. And that's really where things took off in the 60s, where he came across some young actors, including Peter Fonda and Jack Nicholson, who he had already been working with. By the way, Jack Nicholson was supposed to be a producer and director. You know, he was going to be a producer and a writer, but ended up acting. And so with Jack Nicholson and Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper, who also, by the way, was also a very well-known actor by that point, he had already worked for years in the business alongside people like James Dean, Montgomery Clift. So you know, Dennis Hopper was pretty well known, but they were all in now hippies. And so Roger ended up directing a movie called The Wild Angels, which I mentioned already, and that was in 1966, and that did really well. And then Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper came back to him with the idea of making a movie called Easy Rider. Well, Roger didn't own his company. He worked for AIP, and he went back to the bosses and brought this idea, and they didn't want to do it that way. They thought Dennis Hopper was not reliable, and they had changes, and Roger took it back, and Peter Fonda, they got offended, and they said they'll make it the movie on their own, and that's, of course, what they did, and Dennis Hopper ended up directing Easy Rider, and, of course, it changed the movie industry overnight, and so that movie they didn't make, but they did go on to make lots of other films, including, of course, but The Wild Angels, even though it's not nearly as solid a film as Easy Rider, it did precede Easy Rider by 3 years and shook up things, and so it sort of really did create quite a name, and Corman directed it. So there's that. Then a year later, after The Wild Angels, was The Trip, which starred Peter Fonda, and it was about taking LSD, and it was all about just what the title suggests. It was all about a trip, and I watched it. I had never seen it before, and I watched it recently, and it's definitely worth watching. It's a very, very trippy film, and on and on. So, and then Roger Corman turned his attention to producing, primarily in the next phase, through the 60s into the 70s and 80s, and he hired, I'm going to just name a few people and the projects that they were best known for, and what they may have worked on at the time. There was, of course, Coppola, who was there from the beginning, Martin Scorsese, who Corman produced Boxcar Bertha for Martin Scorsese. That was, I think, Scorsese's first film, at least the first film that was released. He produced the Grand Theft Auto with Ron Howard, who was, of course, a very famous actor, having done The Andy Griffith Show and Happy Days already, and wanted to become a director. And he agreed to give Howard his first shot if he would act in another film. And then he ended up producing Grand Theft Auto for Ron Howard. And then Howard, of course, went on to make many, many other films. Alan Arkush was working for Corman for years before he became a director. And he ended up making, perhaps most famously, Rock and Roll High School. Peter Bogdanovich, Paul Bartel. Corman produced Death Race 2000. Jonathan Demme was directed and was a second director for, or was a assistant director for Corman. Gail Ann Hurd, Joe Dante, would end up making a film called Piranha years later, and that was written by John Sayles, who was a regular writer for Roger Corman. Of course, John Sayles has been on the show. James Cameron, who would be the most successful film director, I mean, from a financial standpoint, it went to the Roger Corman school. Monty Hellman made a number of films, directed a number of films, in a couple cases, co-producing with Jack Nicholson. Robert Towne, another, and on and on. At the same time, Roger Corman, lesser known for this, that he was imported and distributed world cinema, bring it from Europe and other points around the world, and he would bring it to theaters in the United States. Film titles from Ingmar Bergman, Truffaut, and Akira Kurosawa, just to name a few. So he has this incredible, illustrious career, and it's the longest intro I've done for anybody. But I really feel like all the work I've been doing is leading up to, in a sense, this point of bringing on Roger Corman. So this is kind of the first, hopefully just part one. I hope to have another conversation with Roger soon. It may have to be over the telephone, but who cares? This is me sitting with Roger Corman, you know, one-on-one. After that on the show, after Roger, we have a segment with a young filmmaker named Kent Moran. And Kent was kind enough to join me. He was up in Connecticut. He came down to talk to me anyway, and I said, let's meet at this hotel. I'm going to try to get Roger Corman. You can come and help me out and maybe take some pictures and video and just be, you know, come with me. And he did, and it worked out beautifully, and then we stuck around afterwards, and first part of that conversation, which is coming up after the Roger Corman, we kind of do a post-mortem, and we talk about, you know, just how wonderful that, we were both kind of giddy from it, as you'll hear. And then we talk about Kent's film, his first feature. It's called The Challenger. He's an actor, but this is the first movie he's directed, and he acts in it. And it's coming out on September 11th at the Regal Cinema, at least in Manhattan, on the 11th at the Regal Times Square. And then it's coming out of a bunch of other cities through Regal. They're doing a whole thing with this filmmaker. And so we'll have Kent on to talk about that film, which is a boxing film, a boxing story, which he trained for, to play this boxer and to portray the boxer in an authentic way. And he accomplished that, I should add. So we'll have on Kent Moran. And then the third segment of this episode is with the author Dwayne Epstein, who has a terrific book about Lee Marvin. It's called Lee Marvin, point blank. It's published by the Schaffner Press, and we'll get to that and my conversation with him. And he'll tell us all about Lee Marvin, the actor, the personality, the man, you name it. So all that's happening on this episode, number 311 of the podcast. Thank you for putting up with that incredibly long intro. Without further ado, my conversation with the producer, director, and actor, Roger Corman.
You keep saying you got something for me. Something you call love, but confess. You've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin'. And now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk
away. Oh yeah, do you mind? Should I always ask
no
first? Okay. I actually saw, all right, just talk as close as you can comfortably to the mic.
Okay.
All right.
Can move this an inch closer.
Sure, sure. Anything you want.
Maybe not too. Yeah, I'll put this over here.
All right. Anyway, I can usually fix those types of things anyway. You know what? When I was passing by the, when I was coming on over, I was thinking, I'll just wait. I'm going to call you again, and I'll see what happens. I didn't expect I was going to pass you, and I said, should I ambush Roger Corman?
Why not?
But I thought you could either be amused or really annoyed, and I thought,
fine.
Given all that I've read about you and seen you in interviews, I thought he'll probably be okay with it.
Sure,
so,
sure.
And I already have plans to talk to my friend Kent, who's a filmmaker, by the way, this young man, young guy here. And I said, meet me here, and let's try this out. It's sort of an adventure. So,
okay.
So thank you. So you're at the over at the Film Anthology Archives being feted and making a couple of appearances, right?
Yes, one last night and
one. How'd that
tonight.
Go last night?
It went very well, as a matter of fact. The questions from the audience were fairly sharp. They were good.
Right. Well, they're going to be diehard serious people, like serious, you know, cinephiles, I suppose. And also, because you're doing something so specific and unique, right? You know, they have to really know what you do and what what's so.
Zero in.
Yeah. So those were the types, the serious New York hipster. And when was the last time you were in New York?
My two daughters live in New York, so we visit them fairly frequently.
Oh, you
we
do?
We were here just 3 weeks ago, as a matter of fact.
Oh, you were? Okay. So, because I just thought an urgency, but now that I know you come often, I'll just find out where you're. I'm just kidding. When I saw this coming up, I just thought, let me try to do this because Monty Hellman, I talked to Monty Hellman on the show, and he is what a great guy. And I just did, I was in Austin last spring and I talked to John Sayles for like an hour.
Oh, very good. John is very, very bright and can be when he wants to be very funny.
Yes. Right. He can get kind of serious too. He's a sociopolitically minded guy.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Do you put yourself in that category?
Or to a certain extent, I'm on the left side of the political spectrum.
Okay. Yeah, I know. But you were raised very different than that, right? Your dad was an engineer?
My father was an engineer, and like many people, when he was young, he was liberal, and as he got older, he became a little bit conservative. This seems to be a fairly strong pattern. Many guys I know who were liberal when they were young have gotten conservative.
What do you owe to that? Maybe just kind of more anxieties in your life, and you feel like...
I think so. I think also maybe you lose a little bit of your idealism. You become a little bit cynical when you're young. You say, okay, we can fix this. And 40 years later, you say, wait a minute, we've been trying to fix this. We haven't fixed it. I'm not certain we can ever fix it.
Yeah. I've read a lot since I thought I might be able to meet with you about you. You know, I have a couple of books. And I was wondering if you thought you if you could just maybe since we don't have a lot of time, if you could illustrate one instance where you slipped in a message. And I know it was all done tongue in cheek when you did do it, because you weren't trying to get all sanctimonious ever. Certainly not. That wouldn't appear in any of your films, sanctimony. Well, but you did. Yeah. You did try to slide some messages in, right?
Yes, I had done a picture called "The Intruder," about racial integration in the South with Bill Shatner in his first picture. The film got wonderful reviews, won a couple of minor film festivals, and was the first film I ever made that lost money. So I felt I can learn something from this, that I was maybe a little bit too sincere, too straight, maybe lecturing the audience. So I felt the first thing is I must entertain, and then maybe underneath, subtextually, there can be a little bit of a statement. I wanted to do a picture about Ma Barker, who was a rural southern gangster in the 1930s. Her farm had been dispossessed during the Depression, and she took off with her four sons and became a rural famous gang robbing banks. So the picture, Shelley Winters played Ma Barker.
And who was discovered at that
time? Her sons were Bob De Niro, yeah, Bruce Stern, a couple of other guys who all went on to have good careers. So on the surface, this was a straightforward shoot-'em-up gangster picture. Beneath the surface, there was the statement that her farm had been dispossessed because of the Depression. So there was a social statement there, but it was always beneath the fact that guns were shooting and cars were racing around the country.
Understood. And it's interesting that, you know, whether it's, I don't know, Ruby Ridge or something that's happened over again, like that history keeps repeating in that way, because it's kind of that spirit of being against the government, against being or being angry at the government, resentful against the government for getting involved and being the cause of your financial strife or what have you. And so, you know, I feel a little also self-conscious asking what I know as you're in your 80s and you've done thousands of interviews and thousands of appearances to ask the same questions. But you mentioned like De Niro, of course, Bruce Stern, and really at the end, I still don't quite understand with like, it's a good thing I wear headphones. I wouldn't have noticed that my batteries ran out. Has that happened on your productions?
Yes. Okay. Everything can go wrong eventually.
I'm a little flush now from embarrassment, but I'm going to recover, I think. Well, speaking of which then, the last thing you directed it was a long time ago, and it was the Frankenstein movie, right?
Yes, Frankenstein Unbound.
Right.
It started when Universal did some market research, and they came up with a result that a picture called Roger Corman's Frankenstein would be successful. And they asked me if I wanted to make it, and I said, no, I don't believe your research. There have been so many Frankensteins. It'll just be the 75th Frankenstein.
Yeah.
But they kept calling me every 6 months, and each time they raised how much money I was supposed to get. So I finally said, well, okay, if we're talking something like that, if I could find something, a new version of Frankenstein. And there was a novel called Frankenstein Unbound.
Okay.
And I adapted that novel.
Well, you're not the only one who had maybe did not recoup. From I think Kenneth Branagh had a version of Frankenstein with Robert De Niro. Do you remember
yes.
that?
Yes.
That was a flop, too.
Yeah.
So he had the same...
It's been done too many times.
Too many times.
I think it's really a great... I had never read the original stories. Obviously, I read it in preparation for this. And I thought, this is a brilliant novel. People are really not aware of how good a novel it was.
The Mary Shelley book.
Mary Shelley.
Yeah. They teach it in schools. It's on a lot of school reading lists.
Well, I didn't know that.
I'm making that up.
That's why I didn't know it.
Don't quote me. So, have you ever seen The Walking Dead or one of those shows?
Yes, actually, that's made by my ex-assistant, Gail Ann Hurd.
Is that? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that. So, of course, you had to watch it. Yeah. What do you make? Because obviously, it's basically an expansion or a variation on the same theme of what you were doing. It's boogeymen still, and right. I mean, maybe fewer exposed breasts, unfortunately. But you know, it's not on HBO. It's on AMC, right? Yeah. So.
Well, it's very well made. It's intelligently made.
Yeah.
And it combines, there was a novel Dick Matheson wrote, the title escapes me, but there are some elements of Frankenstein, some elements of zombies,
yeah,
obviously. And Dick Matheson, who is the last man alive, mm-hmm, and other people have become, if not zombies, something like that. And it's a story of them trying to get at him, and he's holed up. So what Gail did, she combined all those elements.
I see. Well, it's turned into quite an enormous... It's like now there's another series, right? Anyway, it's turned into a huge thing. And but you didn't go back to directing. Was it because of the disappointment of that experience, or was it just because it's easier for you and you know how to do it producing and you feel like it's more gratifying?
Well, the years have caught up with me. When I was young, I started as a writer, then a director, and then a producer, and I've directed, I think, almost 60 films, 58, 59, something like that. And at my current age, which is 89, it's tough to get up there and go out at 6 o'clock in the morning and start shooting. It's easier as a producer to show up at 9 and say to the director, what do you shoot that shot for?
I guess so, yeah. But congratulations certainly on the retrospective over and the appearances. Are you're producing to this day? People probably want to know. Are you still producing to this day?
Yes. I don't make as many as I did. When I had my own distribution company, I was making 7, 8, 9, 10 pictures a year. We had to, as we used to say, feed the dinosaur.
Yes.
We had to make enough films to
feed the distribution. Or the dino-croc, in your case.
Yes, dino-croc indeed. I don't have a distribution company anymore. I make about 3-4 films a year now.
Are they right for the Sci-Fi Channel still?
We've done a number of films for the Sci-Fi Channel. We've done films for Sony, and I do some films independently simply for myself, and I go through different distribution companies that I've worked with on and off over the years.
Well, I did. I want to explain to everybody listening, I did ambush you, in fact, today, and you took it. You were really you were great about it. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it. You didn't have to be, and then you squeezed in this with. I know you're a busy day, so I'm going to respect your time, and I'll end the interview for you, so you don't have to tell me to shut up. It's a delight. I really mean it. Like I think my audience will really be excited that we did this. If you could, is there one more tiny favor? It doesn't cost a dime, so I know you'll be okay with it. If you could say do one of those things where you just say, or sort of say, "This is Roger Corman, and you're listening to," and then the name of my show.
This is Roger Corman, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
You got a great voice. I'm sure you've been told that, right?
It's fading a little bit, as many things do when you get older.
I can't tell. Certainly, you don't show any signs of fading at all. I'm sure some people, most people, are telling you that too. But I hope maybe for another opportunity down the line, if and when you have time, I'll call your office or something. We could do it over the phone. So okay, but I thought this was perfect. This was great the way it turned out. So thanks very much.
Very good.
And thank your wife Julie. Is it Julie?
Julie,
right? Julie Corman.
Right.
Very much for me. And Cynthia at your office.
Yes, right.
I'm going to write her a note.
All right.
She was
very
so great.
Good.
Could we just do one or two quick photos and then.
Hi, I'm Mike White.
And I'm Rob St. Mary.
And we're the hosts of the Projection Booth podcast.
If you haven't heard of the Projection Booth, that's okay.
But we think it's time that you have.
We've been doing this for over 3 years now.
And we think we're doing a pretty good show.
Every week we look at a different film and put it in context.
We try to bring you interviews with the people behind the films.
Or experts on a subject matter covered in the film.
We don't specialize in any one particular genre or type of film.
We try to examine every aspect of cinema.
From every corner of the globe.
Even at 3 years, we barely just scratched the surface. surface.
But we're ready. We're ready for you to listen to us.
That's right. Now's the time to give us a shot.
Download us through our free smartphone app.
Or through Stitcher, iTunes, Geek Juice Radio, Jackalope.
Or our website.
Projection-booth.com.
We'll keep making great shows.
Now it's your turn to listen to them.
Okay. Well, again, let's hope that we can set up a phone conversation. We'll provide this to the Corman's office. I should mention, Corman still works to this day. He is still producing films as he approaches his 90th birthday. He works in L.A. at this company he created, and it's still thriving. So hopefully we'll follow up with a part two of the conversation. We'll get more into the nitty-gritty if Roger will humor me. Okay, let's get into my conversation with the young filmmaker and actor named Kent Moran. He is based in L.A. as well, but he was in New York going to his grandmother's funeral, so I both share my condolences as well as my gratitude for Kent coming down and visiting and helping me with the Roger Corman episode and also talking to me about his own film called The Challenger. Here now, my conversation with Kent Moran.
Stop holding back.
I'm doing my best, all right?
No.
What do you want from me?
Your best. If you don't stand up and fight for who you are now, you never will.
How you want to be remembered? How you want to be remembered?
Challenger, rated PG-13, in select theaters, September 11th.
Sorry. No, I'm kidding around. We're talking with Roger Corman. And
yeah, here's Roger.
That was amazing, right? We just,
oh my gosh.
Kent Moran, who's came in from L.A. to just for Filmwax Radio.
Thank
you.
Right.
No, actually, I can't even make that. I shouldn't make that joke because he actually came in for pretty serious purposes.
Yeah,
the past
yeah,
year,
my
grandmother.
My grandmother passed away, so that's why I originally came. She was 104.
So Roger Corman at 89 is a kid, is the kid.
Yeah, I mean, he's got a while to go, hopefully.
And can we also say that I love the fact that grandmother lived to 104 for extremely personal, narcissistic reasons, because in a month I'll be half her age.
Oh my gosh, yeah, well,
and you know,
that's still so young.
It means I haven't lived half my life yet.
Yeah.
If I can reach that.
Let's hope that we all do. I mean, I think with medicine and everything, maybe we'll just be extending our life. I don't know.
Well, also just making better choices and reducing stress.
That's
which
true.
I'm not great at, but I'm trying. Yeah. I would love to get to that point.
Yeah, what a great opportunity, though, to interview Roger just now.
Yeah. Mm. But you made a film called, oh, shit. Just remind me of the name.
My first one?
No, the one that we're going to talk
about. Oh, The Challenger.
Oh, The Challenger, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I've seen, of course, and stars a young, good-looking filmmaker named Kent Moran.
Thank you.
And also known for the last appearance of Michael Duncan Clark, which...
Oh, Michael Clark Duncan.
Clark
yes.
Duncan, excuse me, his last performance.
It is his last movie,
and
yes.
We'll get to that. So there's a bit of a... Oh, it seems like now I've created a shroud of sadness around... and loss around this thing. I apologize.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But you were going to come out to Brooklyn since you're in town for your grandma's recent funeral. And, you know, my condolences to your family, by the way. And which may sound a little shallow since I'm saying it on the show, but I mean it. And then, so you were going to come into Brooklyn and we were going to sit and talk. And then the plan was today on Saturday. And then I... knew simultaneously that Roger Corman was in town doing some appearances at the Film Anthology Archives in the East Village, and that all of a sudden I had finally reached the office and they gave me the kind of the green light that Roger will talk to you on the phone and schedule something with you if he can. And so talked to him yesterday, and he said call back today the same morning. So I thought, why risk? Go to the hotel, wait there, and see if you can, you know, make it happen. So I emailed or called you and said to meet me here instead. And it just all worked out like it couldn't have worked out better.
It was perfect. And thank you for including me on that because I got to meet Roger and be here for the interview. It was fantastic.
Well, yeah, I know. It was like I also knew that I needed somebody with me because I wanted to capture some of that in video and photos for posterity because this is a legend. Like, he's 90 years old, or will be shortly.
Yeah.
I mean, other than the fact that he uses a cane
No, he looked great. I mean,
not only looked great, I mean, he's just, there's not even like, I've spoken to other people his age.
Right.
It's hard to be that sharp at 90.
I think so. And right? he seemed to have great answers to your questions. Like, he was right. spot on, ready to
Some
go.
Some of that might just be so in his fiber because he's done so many interviews.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Oh,
and
yeah.
Like,
most
I can't, I'm not smart enough or original enough to come up with new questions for that guy.
Right.
I mean, I like to think I am. And I thought about it, and then I just thought, do not prepare too much because you can't do that. You can't.
No, I mean, he's probably done more films than anyone out there. I mean,
producing,
it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Producing-wise, at least, yeah. And, no, it was great to meet him, and what a career he's had.
Incredible. So so thank you for being flexible like that. I mean, I know it was to your advantage, too, but
yeah, of course.
It was just perfect thing. I'm like, oh, wait, let's just maybe Kent can come in, and if he gets in early enough, and you ended up getting in earlier than me, and you're texting me. I'm getting texts on the phone, on the train, saying I'm in the cafe waiting, and Roger Corman's sitting at the next table. I'm like, Jesus Christ, keep him there, like Pesci and Goodfellas.
I know. Keep him there.
Keep him there. Incredible. So,
and he was about to leave. You got here like perfect timing.
I did.
He was just
right.
about walking out.
It's a gorgeous summer day here on the Bowery at the Standard Hotel East Village, because there's a few, right? And they've been very nice to us. And that's where we're sitting now. And we're going to talk about the Challenger in a minute. But I'm still kind of high. I'm still buzzing from that incredible experience of that all. More, who cares about the guy himself? It's just how everything fell together so well.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Because he happened to be having breakfast.
It's almost meant to be. We were here. He was there. And
right. And then I thought, should I ambush him? Like, he and his wife were having breakfast. And I could have. I was going to. The idea was that they were, I figured he said to call him back at 11, and I was worried that the hotel, you know, I would have a problem, or that he would say, come now. So I said, well, be there just in case. And then he was here already, so I said, now do I walk up to him, or do I wait till they're back up in the room and then call?
It's that weird dilemma. I've had this before with things, and I think you made the right call, because then he was the one who was like, I don't have limited time, let's just do it here, and then you're able to get it.
Yeah.
Get it great.
Anyway. It might have worked out well that way, too, of course, because then we would have been in a quiet bed in his hotel room, and we could have stolen some stuff. Like,
right.
You know. And,
it's
no,
almost fitting, though, being he's an indie filmmaker, and
right.
you know, this was
yeah.
sort of the environment.
Also, I don't think he probably wanted us in his hotel room
right.
with his wife there and everything like that. Then
that's true.
It would have been awkward.
Yeah.
You know. But then I want to tell people, and again, if the Corman's already up, you'll know that halfway through the conversation, which wasn't very long, he said, I'll give you 10 minutes, in a friendly way. It turned into probably somewhere between 10 and 15 minutes, but he, and I think it could have gone longer.
Yeah, he was, I think, you know, you did the right move by cutting it off a little shorter,
right.
just because you'd rather err on that side, but he seemed to be having a great time and could have gone for a long time, I bet.
Well, Kent, I'm offering you the job as my producer now.
Yes, accepted.
I don't know how we're going to work it out, but you don't have to be in New York. We can do this.
When I stop in, I'll produce with you.
No, you could just produce me from across the country. That's all. You're in L.A., right? Did you go to film school?
No, I didn't, actually. I went to Lehigh University for finance, and then I was an acting and music minor, basically.
Okay.
So.
And then how did you fall into filmmaking?
Well, I grew up in New York and Connecticut, uh-huh. and so I've always wanted to be an actor, but I never really knew how to. I didn't necessarily want to do theater. I knew film and TV was more what I wanted to do. So I guess I was pushed sort of toward business originally, so that's what made me go to the finance business school at Lehigh. And then it wasn't until I got... See, I was reading actually about Roger on the train here, and I had a very interesting same sort of revelation that he did. I had a finance job all lined up, and
he
quit on his fourth day of the job. I quit on my first day.
Oh, really?
And I had the same revelation, like, this isn't what I want to do. Mm. And I told him, I was like, yeah, this just isn't right for me. So I moved into New York City. I started pursuing acting. Couldn't afford to, like, live anywhere, so I, like, slept on my friends' couches for 6 months until I could make the money to move in with one of them on mm-hmm. the couch for a little
bit. In other words, like rent.
Like rent,
pay
yeah.
rent.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And that was cool. And then, you know, I did some first TV roles, a little film. And then I moved out to L.A. about a year after that.
Uh-huh.
And then writer's strike hit in 2008. And
that was
I decided
problem.
To write my first movie.
Oh, that was smart use of your...
Yeah.
As a strike, then start writing.
I know. It seems weird.
But
there was
sense.
No, like, work, you know?
Right. Yeah. So the idea was to finally focus on something that was creative, that would involve acting, even mm-hmm. if it was eventual.
Right.
And then, right. And then, now, but let me ask you before that, what, when you were starting to do acting, did you soap operas or something, or did you do?
I did do a few soaps in the city here.
You did?
Yeah.
Yeah. You got a good face, obviously, probably your
Thank
agent
you.
Told you for that kind of thing too, right? Your features were in...
Yeah, it was sort of known as like a stepping stone, I think, to mm-hmm. get to where I wanted to go. But I think that sort of has changed a lot.
Yeah.
As you know, back in the day, I feel like a lot that used to be the way it was. So
right.
I sort of dabbled in it and then sort of got out of that a little bit.
What was the most... I don't know. What was it? Where was the person you were most excited about meeting early on? Like
early
when
on.
You felt... Or, well, just at any point, maybe on your way to L.A. or like, you know, during that period where you were... Or maybe even in L.A., like where, you know, you realize, oh, man, this career is starting to happen. You know, things are...
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting question. Now, do you mean like who I was excited that I actually got to meet or who I would love to meet? Because I probably still haven't met a lot of
right.
people I would love to.
Oh, I'm sure.
Like Scorsese and De Niro and that kind of, you know, those are mm-hmm. sort of
right.
At the top of the list. But
they may be blocks from here.
What's that?
They could be blocks from here as we
they
speak.
They probably are. They're probably right down the street right there.
You never know because...
Yeah. No, I
they
definitely hope to meet
they
and
both,
hopefully work with
their
them.
Their offices
someday.
Are here, yeah.
Yeah, they live in the Tribeca area, I'm sure. Yeah.
Well, yeah, or, you know, at least they, I mean, they're I'm sure they're all over the place, but they're both based here,
yeah.
I think.
Oh, actually, that brings me, I didn't meet De Niro, but I do extra work very early on my first year acting on that movie he did with Matt Damon. I can't even remember the name of it now. That he directed. He directed the movie.
Oh, right. The good... Was it The Good?
The Good, something sounds similar to that, yeah.
Why am
like
I blanking on that?
Like an old school detective type movie or
okay.
something. Yeah, anyway. So I did get to see De Niro work with Damon, which was cool.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's funny, I did an extra thing once last year or 2 years ago. Can't remember how long ago. And I was seated at the bar, in this bar, next to Alfred Molina and John Lithgow. And they did the same scene like a dozen times, and it was just really interesting to see. And I'm sure I told this story on the podcast before, but, you know, having not been on many sets, especially with real, well, I don't want to say, I mean, this was a case where these are real, you know, seasoned actors, you know, been around for a long time and are at the top of their craft, you know. And to watch them just do the scene over and over and make it, like, real, so good each time, it's really fun to watch, you know.
Yeah, that's amazing. I feel like out of the people I have met, like Michael and working with him, that's how I felt. Like,
oh, yeah. Michael
watching him work.
Clark.
And just Michael Clark Duncan.
Yeah,
it was, I mean, he was, I could have used the first take of everything he did if I wanted to.
Yeah.
But every take he had something special. And then after that, like after three takes, we'd sort of let him do his thing and he would improvise a lot. And a lot of that is in the movie, too.
That's nice.
Yeah.
That's really nice. So, we want to get to that because he's, because of, such an unique, I mean, we all met him in a sense on the Green Mile, the film The Green Mile, which kind of just like, who is this guy?
Amazing,
it was an incredible film, right?
Yeah, he talked to me about that on set and stuff, got to tell me how he prepared for it, how he got that role and everything, and it was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he worked with Larry Moss for that role.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Bruce Willis who recommended him to the director, right?
Oh, Frank.
To Frank, yeah. Frank
Came
auditioned
in.
Him, actually,
yeah.
And then he said no. And then he went and trained with Larry Moss, then he came back and did it again.
Oh, really?
And then he got the role. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
Did you always plan on acting and doing the lead role? Was that you're going to be your... Or did you ever think that, no, maybe I should hire, cast an actor instead
right.
of myself?
Well... Acting's definitely been my main passion.
Sure.
So that's, but honestly, with the Challenger, I was going to give this role to my brother, because I don't know. I just when I first had the idea, that's who I saw in the role.
Mm-hmm.
But he was filming his movie, and which was Boys of Abu Ghraib. It came out like a couple of years ago now, he's also an actor as well.
I see. What's his name?
Luke Moran.
Luke Moran.
Yeah,
okay.
he's my younger brother. So
okay.
Yeah, so he couldn't do it, and I. Was definitely happy to do it. It was a challenging movie. You know, for the budget we had, I was not sure we were going to be able to do it. And that was another challenge. So I was like, I kind of thought I needed to focus on directing or acting.
Yeah.
But I was glad that I chose to do both. At the end of the day, it all came together in the pre-planning. And I think we sort of over-planned, which made the shooting of it extremely easy, actually. So
mm-hmm.
it was great in that sense. Yeah.
I don't know, because it's about a fighter, you know, a young fighter. Well, yeah. You're already kind of over the hill in a way, right? I mean, you're kind of making a comeback too,
yeah.
Isn't it? Right?
No. Well, this fighter, he did fight early on in his life. That sort of got him kicked out of school and stuff like that.
Oh, right. That's right.
But he's still young, relatively young in the movie, and this is his first time professionally boxing.
I see.
Making a go for a
professional career. Yeah. Out of duress, though.
Yeah, him and his mother adopted mother get kicked out of their apartment, and he's got to secretly, because she doesn't want him boxing.
Right, she's really against that.
Yeah, she's really against it, because she knows what it's done to his life in the past. But he's good at it, and with the help of Michael Clark Duncan, becomes great at it, and starts winning fights. And then eventually he wins this one fight that a cable company takes notice, and they see that there's something here. And so they create this reality show called The Challenger that follows him all the way to the light heavyweight title. They give him a title shot, and that's as much as I'll say.
Now you're going
without giving anything away.
Yeah, but now you have you're going through all this drama in your personal life, and you have a film crew because it's a reality show also following you around, and all of a sudden becomes sticky. So yeah, now there's so many. What is it about the boxing story? I mean, it goes back way before even Rocky. In Hollywood.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. I mean, growing up, I loved these boxing movies, and I personally gravitated toward them. And I think it's that it really can be a useful tool in a storytelling device, because you have a character that's struggling in their life, and then you have the physical sort of manifestation of that in the ring. Mm-hmm. It's just you versus one other person. It's not like a team sport where, you know, it's a little bit... It's just very simple and uncomplicated in that way. So
I suppose.
Yeah.
Team sport movies are also very popular.
Oh yeah, also
movies,
great.
But,
yeah,
you know,
definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I think.
Did you go back and watch?
Too,
good.
What's
I'm sorry.
That? Oh, sorry. I was going to say in this movie too. You know, you feel that too. I feel like if you can get the audience behind the character and then put the character in a fight, of course, you know, you want to root for the character. So that's
sure. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Of course. Did you go back and watch any boxing films in preparation?
Oh, I watched every boxing film I think ever made.
Like the original The Champ, was that Wallace Beery or something?
I'm not sure who directed that, actually.
I think it was the actor.
The actor.
Who played the older guy. I'm guessing. Or maybe,
John
I don't
Boyd
remember.
Was in...
Well, that was a remake.
I didn't see the original then, so I haven't seen it.
I think that was a remake.
Okay,
the 70s. Was it The Champ with John... Yes, with John Boyd and a very young Ricky Schroeder.
And Ricky Schroeder, who stole the show in that movie.
Well, you know, he could cry on cue.
Yeah.
And did he... was that before Rocky or after Rocky? That was after Rocky, right? That'd be... That
I
was
think,
the 80s.
I can't remember. I know Raging Bull was after Rocky, surprisingly.
Sure. Not surprising to me. It was 1980 or 81 when that Raging Bull
came
out.
But yeah, I basically watched all those... Yeah. You know, famous boxing movies, but also indie boxing movies, because I knew what our budget was, and I was like,
Rocky was an indie film. I mean, I guess maybe. I don't know if you would consider Rocky an indie film.
Right.
He sold his dog to make that movie. Do you know that? Remember that?
And he it's bought a great it back. Story. Yeah,
it really is. Sylvester Stallone's going to be on the show, though. He's coming up.
Oh, cool.
Not true. No. I have to ambush him in a
awesome.
In a bar somewhere or something like that.
Yeah,
he's gonna do. He's doing another Rocky. So
he is. I know. It's well. The weird thing is that there hadn't been a boxing movie since like The Fighter. You know, I was making this, and then you know, it's taken a little while because we had a lot of visual effects in the movie, filling all the stands with the people. You know, we had about 5,000 people there, and we filled it with 50,000 for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So
is that like a special effects?
It was. Yeah. Basically, we had. They're all real people, but we just put them in the stands.
Right. No, actually. I understand. I was also in something recently, another extra thing. It's so funny because I don't really do that as a practice, but they had us in pews and they wanted to make us look like a bigger group. So we couldn't sit each time they moved us like row by row. Like, and then in order that I guess they were going to just like fill out all the scenes and composite somehow together.
Yeah, exactly.
The magic of,
sometimes they'll have you change your shirt.
Well, in this case, they didn't do that because we're all in kind of a uniform. So, but they did have us. Don't sit next to the same people.
Right.
Each
exactly.
Time. So you know nobody could spot. Yeah. So you did the same thing for your fight scenes.
Yeah. Well, so that's one way to do
theater.
It. We ended up. We had 5,000 people actually there, so we had enough to not have to be so intricate about it.
Uh-huh.
But But I think it looks really great, and my visual effects team did a great job on it.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, the funny thing is that, like, no boxing movies since The Fighter, really. Mm-hmm. Warrior being, like, a MMA movie. And then here we are
that,
coming out with...
That's a shorthand for... That was mixed martial arts, right?
Yes, mixed martial arts.
I figured that out.
And then here we are coming out this year in theaters with three other boxing movies this same year.
Yeah.
So it's crazy.
So wait, when is your theatrical?
September 11th, actually.
Oh, September 11th.
Yes.
Where are you screening?
So we made a direct distribution deal with Regal Cinemas.
Okay.
And we'll be in 30 theaters in 10 of the top 20 markets. So it's and that's the start. And if we do well, we could even expand. So
wow, that's great.
Yeah.
So you'll be in New York?
In Times Square, yeah.
Oh, right. Okay. And that's right on 42nd Street, I believe, right?
That's right, yeah.
And is it? Are you going to be back for that? Or?
Yeah, I'm trying to... Secretly, I want to go to, like, every city and, like, check it out.
Uh-huh.
Maybe even, like, you know, do a Q&A or something at a few. But it might be hard to accomplish. Anyway, I'll definitely be in New York and L.A.
Oh, you are? Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I'm not sure when I'll be here for the actual release, like, on September 11th. But after that, I'll definitely be here to see it.
Okay. Well, it's coming right out.
Yeah.
So, okay. That's good to know for my schedule.
Yeah, it's crazy.
That's a Friday, right?
That's a Friday, yeah.
Yeah, because I know a bunch of movies are coming out on the 9th, too.
Oh, really? Yeah.
That week. Maybe because it's Labor Day week or something.
Yeah, Regal gave us that date, you know, and at first I was like, oh, you know, September 11th, you know, not with what it's associated with. But I think it's good to put positive things sometimes on that date,
oh,
too.
Oh, yeah. And I think actually, you know, for better or for worse, we are in a... kind of moved into a new phase of that period where now it's like recognition, there's enough distance where, or, you know, this is human nature where there are phases, like you can now do things and it's not considered disrespectful. I mean, it's a non-issue when it comes to releasing a film on that day.
Yeah, I feel
people, what are they going to, they still got, you know, they still want to go to the film.
They want to go see a movie.
And
they
it's
don't
good.
Want to
and the challenger...
Yeah.
Directed and starring Kent Moran is Great Escapism, and it stars
That's what
also.
I think, yeah, thank you.
Who else is in it? We already mentioned Michael Clark Duncan.
Then we have
for his last role,
Esapaethe Merkerson, who was on Law and Order for 16 years. People love her in New York. In fact, she was really weird, but she would get recognized everywhere we went in New York. Like,
yeah, no, of course,
emphatic.
Well, yeah, she's a
and she's just
New York
amazing
face.
To work with. I mean, she was. So professional, and there's another actress that I learned so much from just watching her work, and so then her, and then we have Justin Hartley, who was on Smallville, and now he's on he was on Mistresses, now he's on Young and the Restless. But anyway, he was great to work with as well. I had a funny way of how I cast him, actually, because he was like the one guy I was looking at to cast for this role. And similar to the Rogers story today, I was working out at the gym, and there he was at the gym, like right around the time that I was casting this.
Oh, wow.
I had never run into him there before or even seen him. And I was a little nervous to go up to him, so I said, you know what, if he's back tomorrow, I'll go up to him. But I wasn't going to do it the first day. So I came back the same time, and again, he was there, and I was like, that's weird. So I went up to him, and I was like, hey, man, you know, we're doing this film. We'd love you to take a look at the script, whatever. And it wasn't weird. He was really cool about it, and we had lunch then after he read the script, and he really enjoyed it, and it was a pleasure to work with. We both trained. I set him up with a trainer. We both trained at Wild Card Boxing in L.A., which is Freddie Roach's gym.
Okay.
And I trained for like 7 months for it, and then I trained while filming as well in New York. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that had to be super intense to get into
Very
that shape.
Very intense. Yeah. I mean,
did you know you could do it? I mean, you kind of wrote the part and took the part without knowing whether or not you could look like a boxer and show make move and perform like a boxer.
I've always been very athletic. I played like many sports, so I thought I could do it.
Okay.
But while I was writing the script, I was also training as a boxer at Wild Card.
Okay.
So I was actually writing my personal experiences of training into the script directly to make it as authentic as possible, and I think, you know, It was really good. I started really novice, and I think I ended somewhere, you know, good. And that's sort of the journey that he takes in the movie, too. He starts out with not having any boxing experience, you know, fighting experience, but no boxing experience.
Right, that's true. Yeah.
So I thought that would work.
Great. Well, it's a terrific film. I'm glad you...
Thank you.
You know, we met at, I think, very briefly in Nashville, right?
Yeah, Nashville, right?
Yeah, and I didn't see it there, but I saw it subsequently, thanks to you. And I'm glad I did, and thanks for contacting me, and I'm glad we made this all work. And
definitely.
And it's great. That, so you did you self-distributed, and you made a deal yourself?
So on this one, we did. We had
with Regal?
Is with Regal, yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
I like that because I... You know, it's another example of what you know what you can do if you've got a good product, first of all and foremost, and you're willing to try things that are different. You know, and I'm sure that will give you the ability maybe to take it on demand and all those other things.
Yeah, that's
to go to somebody like an online distributor or somebody to do the digital distribution of the film.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we had about 10 distribution offers that. Mm-hmm. And some included very like smaller theatricals, and some didn't include any theatrical. And, you know, at the end of the day, we had done everything independently so far, so we were like, we reached out directly to Regal, and they really felt strongly about it, so I thought it was a great experiment. Let's see how it works,
right.
You know?
Yeah. The Challenger will be opening in New York and L.A. On September the 11th, just days away.
Yeah.
Because I'm posting this probably the few days before that, and other cities.
So it'll be in New York, Chicago, Seattle, Houston, Atlanta, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Sacramento, Orlando, and Los Angeles.
Oh, all on the 11th?
All on the
11th. Oh, all on the 11th. That's amazing. Okay, so so it might be a challenge to get to all those places.
exactly.
Especially for the premiere. Well, thanks for everything. I mean it.
Of course. Thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, I had a great time. Thank you. Last up here, my conversation with Dwayne Epstein, who also lives in Los Angeles, if I'm not mistaken. So all three of these filmmakers, Los Angeles. This one is done over Skype, but it sounds real good. And I did want to bring on more authors, specifically authors who write about, you know, film. And so I did that not long ago with the author of a book about Orson Welles, and now another iconic figure, Lee Marvin. And the name of the book again is called Lee Marvin Point Blank. Point Blank being one of his most famous films. We're going to, of course, talk about that movie and a number of others that Marvin was in, and how he sort of was an unsung actor. So here is my conversation with the author, Dwayne Epstein.
Oh God, Dwayne Epstein. At long last, we find ourselves doing the Filmwax Radio interview.
Yes, we are. Thank you.
It took a number of weeks, but through sheer stick-to-itivism and...
American never-say-die attitude.
There you go. Exactly. So welcome, and thank you for doing this, and thank you... I don't even know how we met. I don't know how... I don't recall how I discovered your book, but Lee Marvin, it's been on my mind since... What did I see him in? Oh, you know what it was? It was my John Borman interview.
Oh, cool.
Which is one of my favorites of all time.
Excellent.
In doing my due diligence, I saw Hell in the Pacific, and I saw, I rewatched Point Blank.
Yeah.
And just thought to myself, why is it that I've never really thought about Lee Marvin as more than just a character showed up in 70s movies or something? Like, you know, like, never really gave him a second thought. And then... Between Hell in the Pacific and Point Blank, it just rocked my world. It just changed my whole perception. I'm like, this is a huge actor.
Yes, well, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. That's how people think of it. I've always been a fan, by the way, but I know a lot of people who feel the way you do about Lee Marvin, knowledgeable people of film, and I've often wondered why there's never been a really definitive biography written about him, because... You know, certain things, such as the fact that in 1967, he was the number one male box office star in the country. And from the establishment of his stardom after a very long apprentice, probably the stardom established like 64, 65, which films he made, from that up until about 1969, he had a string of movies that redefined, you know, the action film or violence in American cinema that had never been done before. And yet... He still kind of remained under, you know, film fanatics or Sinise, or whatever phrase you want to use, under their radar. And I thought it's high time people gave him a second look. And when I started researching his life, the more fascinating thing became that, surprising for me, because I'm a baby boomer, was that even though he was of the so-called greatest generation, he wasn't typical of that generation. He was in many ways, yes, but not in every way. And the more I researched him, the more fascinated I became. He was a product of the Depression. He saw some amazingly violent things during World War II. He was a Marine in the Pacific. He was wounded on Saipan. And I've never had that experience, anything, you know, remotely close to that. So I didn't necessarily know how to write about it, but I can say that in doing the research, as any subject you have, you start to get into that person's head a little bit, as best as you can, of course, him not being around, it's impossible. And I discovered not the person I thought I would discover, and I became fascinated by that. Aside from the fact, I also think he was one hell of an actor, definitely worthy of rediscovery.
Well, you know, I'll start with your last comment and work back. You say what a great actor he was, and that's very true. When he had an opportunity to really shine, and I mentioned two films already where he really was in almost every frame of the films. I mean, between Point Blank and Hell in the Pacific, the latter of which is harder to find, but it's you can if you pursue it. But you really get to see him showcase his talent. And what I remember from reading your book, which, by the way, is called
Point Blank,
Lee Marvin Point Blank, and which I really enjoyed, was the one thing I really stood out was how almost everyone he came in contact with, except for maybe those he, you know, was in court with, but we'll get to that, really just constantly was blown away by his not only his talent, but also his consummate approach and his intensity and his commitment, that's the word, to acting. And it seemed as though, even though he was maybe in his personal life was more troubled, and by the way, who's of that magnitude isn't, but that on the set, he was really Mr. Professional.
Yes, and you know, there's an interesting thing about him in that there's a lot of Lee Marvin's, his status in people's minds is one of an individual who kind of drunk or stumbled from one performance to another and somehow had a career. That's not exactly true. And you know, it would be impossible for somebody to actually do that over a long period of time. Now, I'm not saying the man was an angel, far from it.
No, no, right.
And there were moments, of course, when he would be inebriated. And once I would interview some of the people I interviewed, when they told me about certain incidences that took place and I would rewatch a given project or whatever, you could see it. My favorite, just real quick, is the movie he did. It was a TV movie that was released theatrically called Sergeant Riker. And I interviewed Buzz Kulik, the director, who passed away recently. And he told me that there was an interesting story about how Lee wound up getting drunk that day. That's in the book. Now, I didn't say what the project was because I didn't want to get into Sergeant Riker. It was a, you know, it was a TV movie that wound up being released theatrically, and it was okay. It wasn't great. But that aside, Buzz Kulik told me because he was drunk and they needed him for that day, what they shot instead was just Lee at the defense table. And then Buzz Kulik told me, he said, we just kept the camera on him and other people had dialogue, but we needed him to be on camera. And he said, if you watch the movie, I think you might be able to tell. Right after I interviewed him, I watched it again. It's on VHS. He's face down on the table.
Okay.
It's like this, and his arms are spread out. But if you didn't know to look for it, it wouldn't be that obvious.
Not only that, but he always sort of was one of these actors, and I think a lot of people were impressed. His contemporaries were impressed that he would always add something unexpected into the performance, yet it wasn't also interpreted as being showy or trying to grab the spotlight, but that this was just somebody who was very, very perceptive and who really was, like Brando in a way, was acting from a very raw place, you know, and really put himself into the performance. He was, you know, so, and this is the next point I wanted to get to, not to jump all over the place, but while it's in my mind, Lee Marvin was caught between two eras in a way. Am I right? Like, on one
Absolutely
hand, he's
right.
From the old Hollywood, but he really was before what we now give a lot of credit to Clint Eastwood, Charlie Bronson, and those tough guys. But Lee Marvin really was before even those guys.
Yes, he is.
Which you did get to see a little bit, of course, or a lot in like Point Blank and a couple of other things. But had he come maybe a couple years later, I think probably would have stolen a lot of thunder from like Clint Eastwood. You see it in John Wayne, too. Also came into those roles in his latter years. But, you know, in terms of this new... You put it in the book perfectly. It was like this new anti-hero type of guy, like Dirty Harry, Death Wish.
There's this thing about the action hero. In much the same way, in any discipline of pop culture you want to go with, be it, you know, music, film, television, whatever, there's the old and there's the new. And there's often a dividing line. I mean, in terms of music, they use the dividing line of, say, anything before Elvis Presley or after, right? Like Elvis was rock and roll. He didn't invent rock and roll, but Elvis was the guy. And from after Elvis, everything changed. In terms of action film stars, there was John Wayne forever. I mean, there were others, of course, but they were of a different ilk. It wasn't about making violence real. It was about making action fun. Lee Marvin came along, and he was very specific about it. He would say it in interviews all the time when he would be interviewed for a given project that he wants to make whatever he's doing on film, that's an action scene or whatever, as real as humanly possible. He wants people, he would say it like this, and I've quoted him in the book. He would say, if I'm going to have to get somebody, I'm going to shoot him in the face, knock him down, turn him over, shoot him in the back two more times. And he said, the reason there is because violence isn't fun. I want it to be a turnoff.
Talk about where that comes from. Because the book really spends a good portion of the first, or
came from two places.
The first half of the book, almost maybe first third to first half, really is devoted to his home life, childhood, but also to his years in the military. That really profoundly influenced the way he approached these action characters.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, when he was starting out as an actor, and like you said, he put in a very long apprentice. When he was starting out as an actor, because of his look, he was given only certain roles. You're not going to see him play the second romantic lead like Ralph Bellamy or something. He would be the killer. He would be, you know, what have you. And that was one of the reasons he was cast in those roles. But the reason he was so good in those roles wasn't just the way he physically looked. It was because he had an affinity for violence. He could play it in a way that nobody had ever played it before. And a lot of it came out of his own ingenuity. Did you ever see a movie called Violent Saturday?
No.
It was made in the 50s. Highly recommend. It's this weird hybrid of Asphalt Jungle and Peyton Place. And Lee Marvin is he's a secondary character, and he's one of the guys who come into this town to rob the town. And early on in the movie, when he's scoping out the town of the bank they're going to rob, he's got a Benzedrine habit, the character he plays. And he's constantly using this inhaler. And the very first scene in the movie, a kid bumps into him and knocks the inhaler out of his hand. And when the kid goes to reach for it, Lee Marvin steps on his hand, and then he grinds the kid's hand into the cement. And the camera's on Lee's face, and Lee does that Lee Marvin thing where he, like, you know, wags his tongue a little bit and has fun with it. Now, that's very different than a bad guy, let's say a John Wayne movie, who's, I may be exaggerating here to make the point, but, you know, hands on their hips, and you dastardly fellow, and John Wayne gets to take his time punching him out. In fact, Lee Marvin even made the comment about John Wayne. He said, most action in John Wayne films are two guys beating the crap out of each other in a bar. One gets that typical trickle down the corner of their mouth. They make friends. Wasn't that a great fight? They buy each other a drink. And Lee Marvin made the point that, you know, I've been in bar fights. They're not like that. And he wanted to make these things real. And as he worked his way up the evolutionary ladder in film, working from one level to another, by the time he was able to pick and choose, he always said it was unfortunate. He wanted to make more romantic comedies. He wanted to be this one. Yet, he was able to choose what scripts he went with. And inevitably, he would Point Blank, The Dirty Dozen, The Professionals, Hell in the Pacific. At one point, towards the end of his career, when he made the movie Death Hunt, underrated, by the way, in my opinion. Not great, but not as bad as the reputation that it has. When he was promoting it, I think it was on Tom Snyder, Tom Snyder said, well, tell me about your new movie, Lee. And Marvin said, look, I'm in it. Charles Bronson's in it. It's called Death Hunt.
That's called marketing.
Yeah, he goes, it ain't a romance. These were the scripts he was drawn to. And he always said, too, that what he looked for in a script was something he could identify with, mainly in the character. If he could find something within himself that was like the character. And I was always intrigued by that and fascinated by that. And I think it's there. You can see aspects of the real Lee Marvin in pretty much everything. Even something that would seem not to be the case as removed from him as the character in Point Blank. There were things he did in that movie that he drew from his real life. Such as in the beginning of the film after his wife dies. And he's in the corner and he's like crouched down in the corner. Betty Marvin, Lee's first wife, said that Lee used to do that all the time. And that was clearly a result of the war. And I had never read this anywhere, but based on the research that I did, I went out on a limb and decided to diagnose him myself as having PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, because almost every symptom I read about, he had. You name it, he had it. And after the book was done, I got to tell you this, about 3 months ago, I came back in contact with one of my best sources, a gentleman by the name of Ralph O'Hara, who was a bartender in Santa Monica who knew Lee really, really well. And I got to talking with him again, and I had interviewed him for the book, but this didn't go in the book. He finally read the book, and he said he liked it a lot. I nailed Lee the way I should have, and he said to me that you got it on the PTSD thing. And I asked him, I said, did Lee know he had PTSD? Because I never had read it confirmed anywhere. And Ralph O'Hara told me he most definitely knew that he did, but only at the end of his life. It was only diagnosed in the early 80s when Vietnam vets were showing up at the VA. And by that time, Lee was in his early 50s, late 60s. He died at 63 in 1987. But Ralph O'Hara told me that Lee had a friend who was doing some work with veterans and videotaping interviews with them about their experiences. And this friend asked Lee to watch these videos and pick the ones that would be worthy of a documentary that was going to air on PBS. And Ralph told me that while Lee was watching them, he started turning to Ralph and going, son of a bitch, that's me. That guy's talking about everything I've been talking about. Holy shit. And he was kind of blown away by the fact. So I was relieved to find out my diagnosis was correct. My hypothesis is better than diagnosis.
Well, he did a lot of, certainly lived with him for a substantial amount of time, so.
Yeah, well, and one of the ways I came to that conclusion is by the people I interviewed and the ones who knew him the closest, his son, his first wife, people he grew up with, his agent from his entire career, especially people who knew him more intimately, like slept with him, lived with him, his brother, his first wife, his son. They all told me that Lee suffered from hellish nightmares, screaming nightmares. And that is a direct result of PTSD. I mean, that's a real PTSD symptom.
A telltale sign. Tonight, if you were going to go home, if you were to choose a Lee Marvin movie to watch, which one would you choose?
A lot of it has to do with the mood I'm in. There are just so many. It's like asking, who's your favorite child,
Well, I'm not saying which is your favorite. I'm asking you, sort of just on the spur of the moment, let's say, if you were
just on the mood I'm in, I would say, because I've been talking about it earlier with my girlfriend, and we both love this movie, it's one of my favorites, and not the favorite, but a favorite, is The Professionals. Mm-hmm. I absolutely love that film. I love everything about it. It's a flawless action film. Have you seen it, by the way?
I'm not sure. That's one I may have missed. I'm not sure. I've seen quite a few of the others, I'll have to tell you. Okay, so first of all, let's just repeat. The name of the book, again, is Lee Marvin, Point Blank. It's available, of course, on Amazon and any other retailers. You might find a copy of that. You should.
Indeed. And I'd like to add, if I may, first of all, the hardcover is still in print. It's still selling. It is in paperback. It's available as an ebook, Kindle, whatever other formats they have for ebooks now. It's available on all of those platforms. And also, I have a website that's been getting more and more hits and more successful. It's called pointblankbook.com. And I've been blogging on it for a fairly regular basis, and it looks like it's starting to get discovered because I'm getting a lot more hits. And what the blogs, people should check it out, because what the blogs consist of is all the stuff I couldn't put in the book. So it's like a good denda.
It's like bonus content on a DVD.
Bingo.
The book, I really did. I found it to be a thoroughly enjoyable read. It was almost like, because I knew so little about him, it made it far more entertaining. And, I had a profound amount of empathy for the man. Because he's, obviously lived a very, very intense life. And
Thank
really,
you.
Really tried to do his best, and he had some battles that he had to wage, including PTSD, alcoholism. You know,
I just want to add real quick. I mentioned the PTSD, but you had asked this a moment ago, and I didn't give a. I got off track slightly.
Go ahead.
You know, the war was the most obvious thing that influenced his behavior, but and that seems to be the thing that everybody would point to that I would speak of, but. Actually, it the person he was predates the war. Mm. It had to do with his family.
Yeah,
his family was very dysfunctional.
Dysfunctional, but yeah, in other words, they had a hard time expressing affection.
His family, his father was, his mother was probably would best be described as psychologically abusive, but his father was physically abusive, and I got a hint of that with some of the letters I was able to find. From his brother. His brother let me go through the entire family archive, and I went through everything with a fine-tooth comb. But once again, I recently discovered something that had I known it at the time, believe me, this would have gone in the book. But, you know, you never know when to stop researching, right? And are you familiar with the actor Bruce Davison?
Of course. Big fan.
Yes. I'm sorry?
Love Bruce Davison.
Yes.
Love his acting.
Super nice guy. Excellent actor.
Would love to get him on the show. He's a character actor that... You know, I remember going back to my childhood.
Yeah, same here. I recently came in contact with him via Facebook, and we actually had contact with each other. And when he read the Lee Marvin book, he said, I have a Lee Marvin story for you. And I never thought to contact him because I never knew they worked together. And apparently they didn't work together, ever. But a typical Lee Marvin scenario, Marvin would often open himself up more to a stranger in a bar than he would to his closest friends or family.
Yeah.
And they got some stories that way. Well... In the late 70s, when Lee was filming the movie Avalanche Express, partly in Germany, Bruce Davison was in Germany filming that movie Brass Targets, and they found themselves in a bar together while the other cast members were elsewhere. And when Bruce Davison saw Lee Marvin, he just gave him a little wave. They'd never met before, and Marvin kind of waved him over, and they sat down, and they had a drink together, and they started talking about their lives. And Bruce Davison said... that his father was a drinker, but he was a fun drunk. And
yes.
Lee Marvin told Bruce Davison, I wish mine was. And when they talked a little bit more, this is from Bruce Davison. He said, he asked Lee, he said, what was the worst? And this didn't surprise me, but I really wished it had gone in the book. Lee said the worst was when, I don't remember if he said how old he was, but he was young, and his father had knocked him down the stairs. And his face was full of blood. And he was holding his mouth. And Lee shouted up at his father from the bottom of the stairs, what's it going to take to get you to love me? And his father shouted down, fucking die. And then Lee said to Bruce Davison, he said, that was the worst.
I hope so.
Yeah. I hope so too.
I think the next worst thing would be actually would be dying. Right? Although maybe a bit of him did. And it certainly explains, as your original point was, his... torn spirit, his torn soul, his damaged soul. Yeah. Thank you for sharing all that. Do you have an idea of what your next project might be?
Yes, I do, and I can't say. I'm not a superstitious
person. Give me a hint.
I'm not a superstitious person except about one thing and one thing only when it comes to my writing, because anytime I haven't taken that into consideration, I wind up screwing myself.
Well, nobody's listening, so you should just feel free to just...
No one's listening. That's why I'm doing this. No one's listening.
So tell me the discipline. Is it another actor? I don't even know if it's a biography.
I don't want to say that.
Okay.
I had an idea that I proposed to my publisher shortly after the Lee Marvin book was done and proved to be... He's a small publishing house. He's an independent publishing house. His name is Tim Schaffner of Schaffner Press. I got to get that in there. Mm-hmm. Schaffner Press, as I always say, and as I wrote in the acknowledgement, he's the only publisher in America with any vision. Because I got turned down by everybody, and he said yes. And the result is, it's been the most successful book he's ever published.
Great.
Which
where is he,
good.
By the way?
So, I'm sorry?
Where is he? Where is this publisher?
Tucson, Arizona.
Very good.
And he has his own website as well, ShafterPress.com. And after I was done with the Lee Marvin book, I had an idea, having done the research for the Lee Marvin book, I had an idea that I've been reading film books my whole life. I've been a movie fan my whole life. And I always thought that there's got to be a subject that hasn't been touched yet, and that's what should be written about. And I thought there was a kind of a gap that existed in film literature about you and I grew up as baby boomers with the biggest male stars in American film being the post-war stars. The Gregory Pecks, Burt Lancasters, you know who I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Kirk Douglas, Marlon Brando, mm-hmm. Jack Lemmon, William Holden. These guys all became stars at the end of the studio system after the war, sometimes a little bit during the war, depending on the star. But in any event, I always was fascinated by the fact that not only were these guys all original in their persona in each way, but when the film industry in America was going through this massive change in the 70s, which at the time was written about as being the end of film in America, that it's in free fall, it's going downhill. If you look at the stuff that was written about movies in those days, in hindsight, retrospect, it's now considered one of the last creative period in American filmmaking, because the studio system ended, the rating system allowed for them to deal with stuff they'd never dealt with before, and the audience was changing. So consequently, yeah, like that book that Peter Biskind wrote, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, that dealt with the filmmakers, the new generation, the Young Turks, but what about the guys that were making movies previously and what they were doing in the 70s? I've read Peter Biskind's book and I liked it a lot, but that's not dealt with. You know, the Charlton Heston sci-fi trilogy in the late 60s, early 70s, those are some great movies. Soylent Green, Planet of the Apes, Omega Man's my favorite. The Walter Matthau crime trilogy that he did, Laughing Policeman, Charlie Varick, an amazing film,
yeah.
And The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, those films could only have been starring guys who had a history that we were familiar with because we grew up with them. So now they were playing characters who were middle-aged. They were dealing with menopause, male menopause, and their own mortality. That great line that William Holden had in Network, another really good example of that, where he tells Faye Dunaway that death is a perceptible thing to me now, with definable features. So I thought there should be a book written about that, about those films and those actors and the work they were doing in that time. And I proposed it to my publisher, who liked the idea the way I pitched it, but then when I wrote the actual proposal, he said, I still don't see it. So he gave it a thumbs down. But, this is a rather long-winded way to tell you, from the ashes of that came my next project. And that's all I'll say about it.
Very good. Nice way to end things.
I try.
Dwayne Epstein, thank you. Thank you. And when you are ready with the new book, when it's published and it's coming out, you'll come back on, I hope.
Oh, thank you. I'd love for you to have me again. That would be wonderful.
When Liberty Valance rode to town, the women folk would hide, they'd hide. When Liberty Valance walked around, the men would step aside. Because the point of a gun was the only law that Liberty understood. When it came to shooting straight and fast, he was mighty good.
Well, thanks everybody. Since I belabored the intro, I'm not going to do so again for the outro of the show. So the next episode, among the guests on the next episode, one is a filmmaker named Thomas Leach, who is a British filmmaker, but filmed this documentary in New York called In No Great Hurry, 13 Lessons in Life with Saul Leiter. Thomas came to the States, I don't know, I think it was earlier this year, and we talked, and I'm finally going to post that segment. And the other one is with also a segment that's sort of been collecting a little dust on. And it's good timing because the Toronto International Film Festival is starting only days from now. And this conversation happened last summer, right before the Toronto International Film Festival, with this Canadian filmmaker who lives near some friends of mine. And I reached out to him because I saw one of his documentaries called When Jews Were Funny. And I was really moved by the ending of that documentary, enough so to reach out to Alan Zweig, who is a fixture in Toronto and Ontario. But, you know, not a lot of people know about him in the United States. He's got a brand new documentary called Hurt, which is sounds fascinating, and which is going to be at the at TIFF this year, which is about this guy that he knows named Steve Fanyo, who is a one-legged cancer survivor and who had the incredible accomplishment of doing a cross-Canada run in the 80s. And then subsequent to that, fell into this quagmire of crime and drugs
only to come out of it again. And so he is the subject of this new documentary, which I'm really excited to see. He also, but Alan, that is, has an earlier documentary that he did years ago. It's called Vinyl, and it's about the death of vinyl, or maybe what we all thought was the death of vinyl, since actually vinyl seems to have not died and was on the brink, but has come back. But it's all about these collectors, people that are compulsive and obsessively collecting vinyl records. But it's really more about loneliness and sort of a self-imposed social exile, people that collect in order to avoid other things in their lives, like connecting to other humans, for instance. And I think Alan was, this movie was made right before he came middle-aged and was probably going through a very, very lonely period. And maybe he felt like he could go either way, where he could get swallowed up by his own antisocial tendencies or make a real break and try to connect and have a life with a family. And it's an incredible film, really. And it doesn't come up with the answer at the end. But if you know Alan, as I've gotten to, I did get to, of course, meet him and talk to him, and you'll hear that conversation next week, and you'll learn how it all turned out. So you can see Vinyl on YouTube, by the way. And I think you can still see When Jews Were Funny streaming on Netflix, unless I'm mistaken. That's how I saw those two films. So if you want to do some research, or just Google Alan Zweig, and it's Z-W-E-I-G. So Alan and Thomas will be on the next episode of the podcast. I'm looking forward to posting that as well. So until then, thank you for listening to this episode. Thank you to Roger Corman and to his office, and to everybody who helped. And thank you to Kent, and thank you to Dwayne for this very special episode of Film Wax Radio. My name is Adam Shartoff. Thank you for listening. Until next time, take care.